Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. Hey everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to another episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. I'm with a really interesting guest today with Jeffrey Lee Campbell. He has toured the world as Sting's guitarist. He's got a great musical career, and he also wrote a book about his experience. It's called Do Stand So Close, My Improbable Adventure as Sting's Guitarist. Great book. We're going to talk about it today. And he's a super interesting guy, and he's really done a lot and sort of like been there and back a couple of times. Originally from North Carolina, he started playing guitar at age 8. He played his first paying gig at age 13. After high school, he was accepted into the studio music and jazz program at the University of Miami. So he went down there. Ultimately, he wound up relocating to New York City, and he quickly established himself as one of the top musicians in the city. I was about to say here in the city as if I'm still there. I don't know why. That's really bizarre. I've been gone since 89. His performance experiences range from iconic intimate venues such as CBGB, now a John Varvatos clothing store, The Bottom Line, now NYU, now an NYU campus, The Bitter End, MTV and NBC's Saturday Night Live, to huge concert stages, including New York City's Madison Square Garden, London's Wembley Stadium, and Japan's Tokyo Dome. He also toured around the world on Sting's Nothing Like the Sun World Tour, sharing the stage with musical heavyweights like Branford Marsalis, Mino Cinelu, and Kenny Kirkland in 25 countries across 6 different continents. God, that sounds exhausting just reading it. In addition to Sting's world tour, Jeff was also a part of Amnesty International's Human Rights Now world tour that featured Sting, Peter Gabriel, Bruce Springsteen, Tracy Chapman, and Yasuo Nador. One of his top Amnesty highlights was sitting in with Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Back at home in New York City, he had the extreme pleasure of playing guitar with Aretha Franklin for VH1 Divas Live, which was an all-star tribute to Aretha at Radio City Music Hall. The concert climax with a finale that found him jamming with Aretha, Mary J. Blige, Nelly Furtado, and surprise special guest Stevie Wonder. Other performance credits include John Bon Jovi, Michael Bublé, Bob James, and singer-songwriter Sam Phillips. As a studio musician, Jeff has worked with some of the industry's top producers such as T-Bone Burnett, Phil Ramone, Rob Cavallo, and David Foster, as well as legendary engineers Bob Clearmountain and Elliot Shiner. He's recorded at famous New York City studios, The Record Plant, The Hit Factory, Avatar, which is also known as The Power Station, Quad, Unique, Sear, and many more. His extensive Broadway credits include Saturday Night Fever, Seussical, Mamma Mia, and he's currently has the guitar chair at the School of Rock, the musical. Jeffrey Lee Campbell, man, thanks so much, Jeff. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks, Craig. I'm tired listening to all of that.
I'm too. We're done, man. Let's go have a beer.
He saw an old picture of himself, Jeff Watts, the great drummer. He said, man, I need a nap.
Well, man, I want to get into this because you're really interesting. You've done a lot of cool stuff, and I'm really interested in your book. And it was a fantastic book. And so let's talk about it. You grew up in North Carolina. You started playing at a really young age. And I was curious, was that like part of a bluegrass family band maybe? Or
Well, I wish.
Or if I watch, if I listen to too many musicians, because that's like you start playing at 8 in North Carolina, it's like, okay, yeah, my dad was a bluegrasser, my uncle, right? Isn't that usually the story?
Yeah, and I wish the five-string banjo and mandolin are all like strange animals to me. I wish I knew how to play them. I grew up in a college town. I grew up in Chapel Hill, actually Carrboro, which is across the tracks from Chapel Hill. So my upbringing, even though you go 20 miles in any direction, you're in tobacco farms, but it was kind of a more of an intellectual community, a progressive community, even, you know, in my childhood. So, no, I was playing in fraternity bands at fraternity parties. You know, I'm 13 and I'm playing Allman Brothers and, the Spinners or the Temptations, you know, whatever the people wanted to hear. So I started playing at high school bands or dances, I should say. I started my first real band in junior high school, middle school, I guess they call it. But yeah, it was frat parties and proms at schools, you know.
You know, you're not supposed to say frat. I can't, you know what they say when you say that.
What?
You can't call your fraternity a frat because you wouldn't call your country a, you know.
Oh, God, I never heard that.
I was in a fraternity, and that's what they used to tell.
Okay, I used to play fraternity parties. That's where I cut my teeth, fraternity parties. And unfortunately, developed a taste for beer along the way at too tender of an age.
Yeah, man, you must have been a really great player, though, to be playing in playing with much older kids and playing at a, you know, in demand level.
You know, a couple of guys, some of the band members were a couple of years older, but, you know, we found the cats that wanted to play. And like I said, I really cut my teeth on Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore, Led Zeppelin 2. And, you know, we would, our idea of a fun Friday night, a friend of mine, his parents let us rehearse in his basement. So a fun Friday night for us was going down in his basement and turning off the lights and pretend like we were playing at the Fillmore East and play the entire, you know, Whipping Post for 20 minutes or whatever. That's what we did. Now, the part that's, 11-8? Yeah, 11-8. I was thinking 13.
It is
11-8. We couldn't figure that part out, so we always stumbled through it. But you know, that was playing in bands. You know, and we were playing. I remember doing a talent show where I played a Santana tune and "Tighten Up" by Archie Bell and the Drells. I mean, we played anything and everything. You know, so.
You know, it's interesting. You just said that about Whipping Post. Think of how few songs have become major hits with an 11-8.
Yeah, right.
I mean, seriously, that says something about a groove of that song, man, because normally people...
Well, it goes into 4, but the intro, after the chorus, it goes back into 11, and that's where I was like, we don't understand what's going on here.
But that's a great song, man. Hey, so you grew up in Carrboro, and then you headed to Miami, and then New York City. Even though that Carrboro was a more progressive town, I would imagine that you're pretty adventurous because it's still a small place relative to Miami and New York.
Yeah. Miami, it was serious culture shock for me. It's funny, when I wanted to go to Miami because I had a very reputable music program. Before I was there, it included Pat Metheny, Jaco Pastorius, Will Lee, Hiram Bullock, Bruce Hornsby. It had developed quite a reputation. So I remember when I was applying to schools, foolishly, I look back on it, I only applied to one college, the University of Miami. And I remember my mom saying, don't you want a fallback plan? Shouldn't you apply to University of North Carolina just in case? I said, if I get a fallback plan, I'll use a fallback plan. So it was like Miami or bust. And I got down there and I always joke with people, I was like, you know, where I grew up, there was two ethnicities, black and white.
Yeah.
And I got down there and it was Jewish, Italian. A lot of Northern kids went to school in Miami. So I was surrounded by all ethnicities and Cubans. And I was like, it was head spinning for me.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And not to mention the level of players in the program, because, you know, I thought I was a jazz guy because I could play a 13th chord. And I got down there and there's guys playing Charlie Parker solos on guitar or John Coltrane. I was like, whoa, I got a lot of learning to do. So I got my butt kicked very quickly at University of Miami.
Who is down? I've interviewed a bunch of guys that are around our age that went down there. Who was down there guitar wise that you played with that you remember?
Well, a friend of mine, John DeFaria, who's out in L.A. now, he played with Kenny Loggins for years, and Gloria Stefan. She was putting together Miami Sound Machine right around that time. So John Hart, who's now the head of the University of Miami School Guitar Department, was one of my fellow students.
Was Adam Zimmern there at that time?
Maybe, but that name does not ring a bell.
Andy Timmons, I think he went there too.
I don't know.
Interesting.
A lot of great players there. And again, from, you know, much like New York, Miami was like everybody most likely to succeed from their small town came there. So the level of competition was very high.
What was different by the time you went up? Well, I guess what prompted you to go to New York? And was that an additional cultural shock or not really after you'd been in Miami? Well,
what happened, and I do cover this briefly in my book, I will say to the listeners, I tried to write a really breezy book that moves quickly. I saw a quote one time from Questlove, the drummer for The Roots, and he said he always skips the first 100 pages of a memoir because it's so boring. So people talk about that their grandfather was in World War One or whatever. So I did not do that.
No, you did it.
I kept a very quick story, but as I say in my book, after I dropped out of Miami and went back to North Carolina because I had a group of friends and we had a band, and we were getting some label interest from overseas. And so we were playing, you know, cover tunes, but also writing originals. And I was like, I'd been in Miami and it was really jazz focused. And I was like, you know, I'd come to the conclusion I did not want to be a jazz player. As I say in my book, Miles, Train, and Bird ruled the classroom, but Earth, Wind, and Fire ruled my dorm room. Yeah. You know, it's like I grew up on pop music. I'm a pop music guy. So I went back to North Carolina, played in a cover band / original band, and we really tried. We signed with an indie label, released an EP. But after a few years of that, it just was going nowhere. And I had a college buddy that lived in New York, and he's like, come up and give me a visit. So I came to New York, and boom, love at first sight.
Really?
So I mean, I just thought, oh, this place is so cool. I mean, it was jumping. We're talking the mid-80s, and it was live music everywhere, and it was so cool. So I went back to North Carolina, put together a plan to, you know, move to New York. And it took me a couple of years, but I saved money. And then I moved up here. You know, I did not do it because I've seen people move up here with $100 in their pocket. And that doesn't last long.
That's lunch.
Yeah, right. So I went back to North Carolina and visited New York a couple times, but then moved up here for good in 87 and said I would give it 1 year. And as I tell people, on the eve of my 1 year anniversary, I was playing Madison Square Garden with Sting. So I was like, that first year was pretty successful.
Yeah, that's pretty damn good.
I know, and I always tell people I've been working my way down the ladder of success ever since. But so when people ever ask me, do you think I should move to New York? I always say, you're probably asking the wrong guy. That's like asking a lottery winner. Should I buy a lottery ticket?
Yeah.
Well, I became a millionaire. So New York, yes, major culture shock. But at the time, you romanticize that. The subways, the rats running down the street, the muggers. It's all romantic. You're young. I mean, you're, you know. As you get older, you're like, this is not so cool anymore, but it's the price you pay to stay here, you know, at the center of the universe, so to speak, you know.
This rat thing has only happened in like the last 15 to 20 years, man. That we didn't have, I mean, once in a blue moon, I grew up there, you know, I left in 89, but once in a blue moon, you'd see a rat. Yeah. But I look at like, exposés, and I'm like, fuck, it's like that movie Willard. You know?
Well, there are, you know, the stuff that makes the internet, you know, these crazy things. But, you know, I see them very rarely. But, I will say that. But from time to time, you'll see one. And I was talking to a book editor, and she said, oh, I used to ride the subway, and there was holes in the floor, and you'd look at the tracks and thought it was so cool. You know, it's like the graffiti covered subway trains, you know, what a hip hop video looks like or what a rap video. And it was romantic when I was younger. But as you get older and the struggle's not as romantic as it used to be. But a lot of culture shock, but I didn't care. But again, I hit the jackpot. 8 months into my stint in New York, I'm playing with Sting. I mean, my first job was selling candy in Broadway theaters, and I had to quit the job selling candy to play with Sting.
Do you ever regret that? I'm just kidding.
That's what,
do you romanticize about that, Jeff?
I do not. Because Sting, I auditioned, and then he said, can you come back tomorrow? Can you come back tomorrow? Can you come back tomorrow? And I kept coming home and calling my boss at the candy concession stand saying, I can't come to work tomorrow. And they're like, look, you're going to have to make a choice. And I'm like, okay.
To tell Sting, dude, I got work. You keep making me this work.
Those M&Ms aren't going to sell themselves.
Yeah, Sting, you know. I want to talk about that in a minute. I just want to ask you one question. about the venues. You've played in some really cool clubs, as I joked earlier. Some of them aren't even around anymore, but and major arenas. What are the top three venues for you that you've played in that you liked and why?
Well, and it is, you know, I guess the downside of being in New York for so long, I've seen a lot of change. You know, I keep joking when the president says he's going to bring the coal mines back. I'm going, can you get Tower Records open again?
Yeah.
While you're at
it? Yeah, right. You know, I mean, that was a great.
There's no record stores. There's no bookstores. No. And there's very few nightclubs. The recording studios are now condos. Mm-hmm. But the places you named, the bottom lines at the top of the list, which is now an NYU, you know, building. But, you know, the bottom line was incredible. And all the thing that I still can romanticize about New York, I romanticize it when I walk in the stage door every night at the Winter Garden Theater, the ghosts floating around this town. Mm. I mean, you go in the bottom line, that's where Springsteen got his start.
I saw Van Morrison there.
Yeah, Van Morrison. Prince played there. Miles Davis played there. Yeah. I mean, you're standing on the same stage. And, you know, so the bottom line was a big one, you know. Also CBGB's, the same thing. And the first time I walked in CBGB's, I'm like, this place is a dump. This is CBGB's? Yeah. And then you grow to see, oh, I get it now. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't know what I expected, but it looked horrible.
It was awful.
It was awful. But boy, the ghost floating around there, you know, the Talking Heads, the Ramones, Debbie Harry, the Police. And so, and as you said, John Varvatos' store now, but he, you know, I will say this. I don't know if you've been in it.
I have
but
not.
But they have retained the vibe.
Really? And all right. So I'm going to go in next
John time.
Better
John Varvatos than a Chase Bank.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, walk in there and there's still all the posters on the wall. There's still the band flyers on the wall. It's they really kind of kept the funkiness. You know, it. You know, I'm, you know, again, we're looking for the silver lining in this.
Yeah.
But at least they did retain some of the nature of the space. If you go in, I recommend people go check it out. You can kind of see the ghosts floating around of CBGB's, but that was always a huge one too. And then the Bitter End, which is still up
still
running.
Around.
Great. You know, cause again, you go in there and you go, wow, this is where Curtis Mayfield did his live record. You know,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Half of it's there and half's the Troubadour, I think.
That's up in Harlem.
No, the Troubadour in LA.
Oh, in LA. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Very
yeah,
cool, so, man. I didn't know
yeah,
that.
So yeah, you know, just again, even though I've been here over 30 years, the romance is still there in that regard. Like I said, I'm doing School of Rock at the Winter Garden Theater now. And I walk through that door and I go, you know, Barbara Streisand worked on this stage as a teenager doing Funny Girl.
Yeah.
Al Jolson worked on that stage. So it's not lost on
major
me
stuff, that, man.
Yeah. That you're walking in the footsteps as Sting might say. And it's pretty cool,
man. You know, what killed me, was when, on Bleecker, which used to be my favorite street in the city, there was a pizza shop on the south side of the street called Pizza sure. Box across sure. from Puerto Rico Coffee Shop. They closed down about 5 years ago, man. That was a knife in my heart. I've been going there since I was like 13.
You know, and again, speaking broad strokes, New York's charm used to be it was so mom and pop, but it's not that way now. They're building a Target in Hell's Kitchen.
Oh my God.
It's all banks. It's all Starbucks. You know, for people that come here now, New York, I'm sure, is just as mesmerizing and mystical and exciting. But for somebody that's seen it change, it's like I don't believe in the good old days. I try to avoid that. I think it's bad as an artist to say best music ever made was in 19XX. It's like that's not true. There's good music being made today. You know, it's just that. We've heard so much and seen so much. We can romanticize or remember when it was a different time. I'm right. sure people in the 50s thought that the 80s were horrible.
Right.
And it's funny. When I moved here, I used to romanticize New York in the 40s. I thought, wow, the big band era, World War II, New York City, Swing Street, 52nd Street. And I joke with people now. I say, now the 80s looks like the 40s too. It was CBGB's in the bottom line and the Hit Factory and the record plant. They're all gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I refuse to be the grandpa that says, the good old days. It's like, tomorrow's the good old days.
Man, I'm with you. There's nothing to be gained by looking in the rearview mirror ever, in my opinion.
Well, so many of my friends, they love to, my peers of my age, love to hate on the Grammys every year. And I tell them, you're 50. You know, you're not supposed to like the music that's on there. I said, you know, when Sgt. Pepper's was up for a Grammy, 50-year-olds were listening to Glenn Miller. Man, they're probably, what's this Strawberry Fields Forever crap?
Yeah, that's a great point.
It's like, so don't hate on Kanye. I don't care if you don't like it, fine. But Lady Gaga, they're not making music for your AARP demographic. You know? In the 60s, it was the same way. If you were 50 in the 60s, you grew up on big band music.
Yeah.
So I'm sure Wilson Pickett and the Beatles sounded very strange to your ears.
That's a great
But now
point.
We revere those bands.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And people say, all the good music in the 60s, and I name all the trashy one-hit wonders, and I go, it's the good music has survived.
Yeah.
We need some perspective to see what's good now. And I think there's plenty of good music being made, but we won't know for 20 years.
Man, that's a great point. And one more question, you've worked with so many people. I just wanted to get a quick overview, how you got the gig, and if you have maybe an interesting or cool story about your experience working with them. Let's talk with Aretha first.
Well, Aretha, so amazing. You know, I'll try not to be too, digress too much here. I was doing Seussical the Musical on Broadway. The bass player in Seussical, his name was Francisco Centeno, who was Aretha's bass player. I'm sitting on my couch one day and my phone rings and Francisco says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Sitting on the couch waiting for the cable guy." He says, "Grab a guitar. Come to SIR, Studio Instrument Rentals. It's on 52nd Street, three blocks away." I grabbed my guitar. He said, "Aretha's here and needs a guitar player."
Holy shit. Yeah.
So I went from sitting on my couch to 10 minutes later being in a room with Aretha. And that day, it was for this big gala they were doing at Radio City for VH1 that ended up being an orchestra of 40 people. But we rehearsed for 2 weeks. The first few days, it was just the rhythm section and Aretha. So I went over there. And in walks Aretha, sits down at a grand piano with a plate of chicken wings on it. She already had her chicken wings there. And
is that her thing? Like,
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. But there's the queen sitting at the piano with me. Her son played guitar. They were bringing in a second guitarist because they needed somebody that could read music for all the special guests that were. They wanted, you know, to beef up the orchestra. So it was drums, bass, Hammond organ, two guitars, and Aretha at the grand piano. And not to digress too much, but it's important to tell the story. She, for some reason, wanted to play this old jazz standard called Cherokee, which, I had learned in music school, was in the real book, and I'd spent years bad-mouthing my jazz studies, saying, what if jazz studies prepare me for in the real world? That day I found
it. Boom.
Because I knew Cherokee. And the bass player is like, "What's the bridge? What's the bridge?" And this divine guidance came back from my college days, and I was playing the changes to Cherokee, and I had taken in. I have like a hollow body Guild guitar because I think that old R&B stuff sounds like hollow bodies to me. It's not Stratocasters. If you listen to Respect or that Sly and the Family Stone stuff, it's 335s and stuff like that. It's hollow body guitars. So I had this big Guild jazz box playing Cherokee, and Aretha was smiling from ear to ear. And I think it might have cinched the gig for me. So I've stopped bad-mouthing Cherokee. But so we proceeded
Your tuition dollars hard at work there, man.
And we proceeded to play through her songbook, you know, her catalog, I should say. And I remember walking home and bumping into my neighbor, and he's like, "Dude, you look like you're in a daze." I said, "I just played Respect with Aretha Franklin, you know?" And I'd played that at a million weddings with some good singers and some bad singers. And I tell everybody, at least I played it right once.
Yeah.
Aretha is 5 feet away from you sitting at a grand piano smiling at you as you play Daydreaming and I'm Thinking of You, Respect, Seesaw, Think. And you're just going, it was a religious experience for me. I mean, I'd been at the mountaintop that day.
What was her energy like?
I'd always heard she was kind of, you know, standoffish. You know, you always hear these stories about, you know, don't address them, don't look them in the eye, don't touch them. I don't know. So it's pretty welcoming. You know, you hear that about Streisand or whatever, you know, and the big stars. So I was intimidated for sure, and I kept my distance. But she was pretty warm and welcoming.
That's really cool.
And again, the people that performed for her was Mary J. Blige, Kid Rock, Nelly Furtado, the Backstreet Boys. The jazz tribute that night was Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter.
Holy crap.
And I'll tell another story. You can edit all this out if we
get too much. This is great, man.
My buddy Russell Malone was playing guitar in the jazz group. And I knew Russell because he had played in Harry Connick Jr.'s band with my brother. My brother Will played alto sax with Harry for 3 years. So I knew Russell. So we're at soundcheck at Radio City, and I'm sitting in the audience, you know, sitting out in the seats watching Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter. I can't remember who else was in the band. And Russell in there on stage, and Russell's got a new guitar. And he goes, Jeff, come here. I want you to feel my new guitar. So I get up on stage and strap into Russell's new whatever arch top he's got. And I look to my left, and there's Herbie Hancock. And I look to my right, and there's Ron Carter. And I look out, and it's Radio City. And I'm like, this kid does not belong here. I was like, nuts. Russell, take me. It was like, it was truly one of these things does not belong.
That's man.
Huge Herbie Hancock fan because he stayed young. He's 80 and he was the guy that was putting vinyl scratching on his records when nobody wanted to hear it. He was singing through vocoders like auto-tune when nobody wanted to hear it. Herbie is my hero because he has found the fountain of youth. Listen to new music. You know, that's what I tell people. There's the fountain of youth.
Man, he had this song on like his first or second album, Watermelon.
Watermelon Man, sure.
No, it wasn't Watermelon Man. It was something, I'll look it up real quick right here. It was Herbie Hancock. Here goes. It was called, Cantaloupe Island.
Oh, Cantaloupe Island. Yeah. Sure.
What a great song. I assume
that was a follow up to Watermelon Man.
Maybe. I don't know.
And then he redid Watermelon Man on the Headhunters record that had Chameleon on it. And it did like a total electronic version of it. So yeah, Herbie. I mean, you go listen to Maiden Voyage. And Dolphin Dance, then you listen to Chameleon, then you listen to Rocket with the vinyl scratching on it. Then he does a record of Joni Mitchell covers, and he has Christina Aguilera singing with him. I saw him with Derek Trucks on The Tonight Show one time. It was one of the best things I'd ever seen. Just because the cat he oozes this inspirational, let's make music together. Yeah. I love him. Yeah. So standing on stage with Herbie at Radio City, I was like, I got to go.
Did you have headphones on, monitors on your ears when they did that gig with Aretha when you were rehearsing?
Yep.
So when you're playing and all of a sudden you look over and you hear her voice, what was that? Was it weird?
It's kind of an out of a body experience just to be around that kind of greatness. The musicality, just some people have that thing, and Aretha has that thing. Yeah. And, when she passed away recently, I went back and started listening to stuff. And I tell people, people roll their eyes when you hear certain tunes are just so overplayed, Respect being Aretha's number. But, I tell people whether it's Stairway to Heaven or Respect or Joy to the World by Three Dog Night, why you're tired of those tunes? Because they were so damn good in the first place that people wore them out. And if you go back, a friend of mine, you say, take a dumb pill and listen like you've never heard it before.
Right.
Put on Respect or I Heard It Through the Grapevine or Stairway to Heaven. And you go, oh my God, this is genius. Yeah. So Aretha, she was the queen.
Man, it's funny you say that. I was in my truck. That's funny just saying truck because I'm from the Bronx. I was in my truck last week driving, and that happened to me. I heard the song Tears of a Clown by Smokey Robinson.
Yeah, right.
I've heard that song 100 times. To me, I always thought it was a goofy, silly party song. And I listened to the words.
Yeah.
That's like a serious love song. The guy got dissed, and I never realized it. And I was like, oh, my God. And it was such a nice feeling, maybe – close to 50 years after the first time I heard that song. I was like, wow, how cool is this how cool is music that here I am rediscovering something and getting a totally new vibe off something that I've heard 100 times.
Yeah. That's
powerful.
That's to me, the music that the ultimate goal is if you can create something that's accessible on the first listen and not boring by the 1,000th listen. And that's what's hard. I always say, being really avant-garde is easy and being really cliche is easy. The sweet spot in the middle of writing something that, and I thought, The Police was one of these bands where it was totally accessible, but it didn't get old the more you listen to it. Yeah. It was not empty calories. You can keep listening. And certainly that all that Motown stuff, I think, as silly as some of the stuff is, it's really deep. And probably has a lot to do with the fact of the session cats that were playing on that stuff that played so well.
Absolutely.
And the human, you know, the communion that's happening with everybody playing. But absolutely. And it's great to hear old music and hear something new. But the thing I always say to people, too, is that when they talk about building a time machine, I say it exists. It's called music, because I can hear a song from my childhood. And for a split second,
you're there,
I'm sitting in my mother's car smelling her cigarette smoke as we're going. She's driving me to school.
Yeah.
For a split second.
That's funny. You know? I have had that. Yeah.
Yeah. At the risk of contradicting myself, because I don't believe in the good old days. I think that these are the good old days. But I do toy with nostalgia more than I used to. I heard somebody refer to it as the narcotic of nostalgia one time. And somebody had said, if you're always looking in the rearview mirror, you're going to run off the road. So I try to not do that. But I will indulge a little more than I used to. I have to admit that I keep SiriusXM tuned into the 70s or the 80s channel or the 60s channel most of the time.
That's cool, man.
And you hear certain tunes and it's just like, I don't know if it's nostalgia or just great music, but the combination, the music industry has beat me down over the years, but music lifts me up as much today as any time. Mm-hmm. I love listening to music.
Well, I think there's either like, you get sucked back to nostalgia when either the time period that which you heard it, you were much freer, mm-hmm. less obligations, less response. For myself, I know, like, I'll get transported if I was back in that day. You know, when you're a kid, your life was basically pretty freaking easy.
Right.
No responsibilities, no obligations. Either that, or I know if I hear something and it causes a memory of a good experience of someone I was with. Mm-hmm. Those two things I always get taken back, and I really enjoy that.
And I kind of always, you know, speaking in broad strokes, whatever tunes you're playing when you're 15 or 16, you're kind of going from being a child through mm-hmm. puberty to kind of becoming a young adult. And I think whatever's on the radio today for 15-year-olds is going to push those buttons for them 30 years from now.
Yeah, I would agree with you.
Which is to test that theory, because my parents, who were born in the 30s, so they were in high school in the 50s. And I'd ask them, they'd listen to SiriusXM. I say, do you listen to the 50s channel? And they said, we listen to the 40s channel, big band music. I said, well, that's not mathematically right. But they all had older siblings.
Oh, so they grew up listening to their music.
They grew up listening to their older siblings' music. So to them, Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller is that, that's a sweet spot.
That's a sweet spot, yeah.
So to me, it's, you know, the 70s. You know, R&B from the 70s. It's funny, I'll go back and listen to recordings of my band from high school, and we're playing Average White Band and Earth, Wind & Fire and the Barquets and the Spinners. And I go, gee, no wonder I got no chops on guitar. It's like, there's no guitar solos in those tunes, you know.
It was all background.
There was no shredding in the 70s. It was Clapton, Hendrix, you know, that kind of stuff was kind of really. By the time Van Halen came along, I guess in the late 70s, I'd kind of found my musical identity. And I always joke, I definitely relate to Steve Cropper a lot more than Steve Vai.
Yeah. It's,
you know, choose your Steve. Yeah, Cropper's my guy. Now, Steve Vai makes my jaw drop when I watch what he does. But if somebody says, hey, let's put on some music and kick back and relax, it's probably going to be Steve Cropper.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'd rather have written and produced Sitting on the Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, which Steve Cropper did, mm-hmm. and play another guitar solo ever again. To me, it's about creating the legacy stuff as opposed to being the fastest gun in the West, you know?
I agree with you. Yeah. I'll tell you, just one, not to belabor this, I had a nice moment the other day. When I was younger, I listened a lot to Monster Magnet. I don't know if you know them. They're kind of like a stoner rock band out of Jersey.
I don't know those guys.
And my son, my older son, likes the same music I do. He's 28 now. And so I spoke to Ed Mundell. He was their guitar player, and he was with them pretty much their whole run. And he's coming on the show. And the first thing I did, I hung up. I said, Nick, I called up my son. I said, I got Ed Mundell coming on the show. He goes, who's that? I said, the guitar player from Monster Magnet. He goes, oh, Dad, that's so cool. Yeah. So that was like minus, because I, you know, he and I used to be in the car. We always used to listen to like different. So that was really nice, man. I really enjoyed that.
You know? I mean, to me, I mean, when I first moved to New York and I would see somebody walking down the street that I'd heard on the radio, I was blown away. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, I've seen that guy on TV. I've seen that guy on the, I hear that guy on the radio. You know, a friend of mine was in the jingle business. So he had, you know, a lot of the singers that were singing on records were also singing on jingles. And, you know, all of a sudden I find myself hanging out with Lonnie Groves, who is the woman who sings the first line on You Are the Sunshine of My Life by Stevie Wonder, which is an interesting tune. But Stevie doesn't come until the bridge. The opening is sung by a woman and then a man, both as background singers.
That's right.
You are the sunshine of my life. Stevie doesn't come into it. I feel like it's the beginning.
Yeah.
So I'm standing there going, this is Lonnie Groves. She's saying You Are the Sunshine of My Life. I can't believe I'm standing in the same room with this woman. So I love that I still get excited about that stuff.
Yeah. You know? Very cool, man. Let me ask you about a few more. Chet Atkins. You know, he was recording up in New York.
Well, I didn't work with him in New York. My interaction with him happened a couple of times, actually, and this is I cover this in the book. When I was in high school, growing up, you know, in Chapel Hill, Carrboro, it's about 10 miles from Durham where Duke University is. And Duke Medical Center had a big charity event every year to raise money for their children's hospital. And one year, my senior year in high school, I got called to be in the house band for the charity event. And the performers included Perry Como was the big, you know, headliner. But Chet Atkins was on the bill. So that's amazing. I met Chet when I was 17. And I discuss this in the book. And he comes out and he starts handing out music for his song. And it's written as a Nashville number chart. And I'd never seen that before, right?
Oh.
And I'm looking at it, just kind of scratching my head. And he goes, do you understand this? And I'm like, nope. So he says, and I hand him the paper back. He very kindly takes a pen and translates the number chart for me into, you know, alphabet so I can play the tune. So fast forwarding 10, 11 years later, I'm on tour with Sting. We're playing in Nashville. And I walk out on stage for soundcheck, and there's Chet Atkins standing on stage with Sting.
That is wild.
He played a Chet Atkins nylon string guitar on our tour. I did all of the electric guitar stuff. Sting played a Chet Atkins nylon string the entire tour. And so Sting standing there with Chet, and I'm like, oh, man, there's Chet. I got to go over and say hello and remind him of us, our history together, right? And like I say in the book, it sounded good on paper. So I went over and interrupted Sting and Chet and told Chet about the good old days in Durham. He looked at me like, who are you?
There was no recollection at all. Nothing. No, he rattling like, on the edges of his head.
Nice story, kid. And then he turns back around to Sting. And at the time, I felt so dejected. But as I say in the book, it's like a dumb bird of youth. It's like I wasn't famous. Sting was famous. Yeah. I was playing guitar with a famous guy.
Yeah.
Sidemen come and go. And Chet was like, yeah, whatever, you know. And so I hate to disparage him, but he was very chilly to me the second go round. But I grew up listening to Chet Atkins and a totally underrated guitarist, Jerry Reed.
Oh,
which
my
a lot
God.
Of people don't.
Nashville, they know him for sure.
Oh, yeah. And Jerry is one of the most musical cats ever. But I remember incredible. My father had some Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed albums, so I would listen to those and never quite understood what was going on. But it definitely informed my playing. So to meet Chet twice was pretty cool.
I actually interviewed a guy named Dave Rowe. Do you know him? He's a bass player.
I do know him. He played
Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. That's what I was going to say. Elvis, but it's Johnny Cash. My wife actually is a singer and a songwriter and a guitarist, and she recorded a track that was produced by Andy York, who is John Mellencamp's guitarist. And Andy said, I want to get this bass player in Nashville to put the bass on, and Dave Rowe played bass on my wife's tune. So
he's a badass.
I've never met him. Yeah, he played bass on my wife's cut. Yeah.
He was married to Jerry's daughter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a great interview. He's hilarious. He's got some great stories about Jerry and him that was just real interesting.
Well, Jerry kind of comes off clownish, but what was the tune? He had a hit. I can't remember, but Amos Moses, I think, or something like that. But, you know, it was kind of goofy music.
Didn't he do Eastbound? Was he the first guy?
Eastbound and Down.
Yeah, right. That was him. I thought it was him. Yeah.
Yeah, so Jerry, there's some stuff on YouTube that will blow your mind how effortless musical it is.
Great player. Yeah. Incredible. John Patitucci. How did that come about?
Yeah. That was in a session in New York, and it was funny because I was you know, scuffling, trying to find work and doing some kind of like low rent jingles for people, the kind of things where you have trouble getting paid. You know, you go do the session and they forget who you are and won't send you the check. But I walked in on a session, and then the bass player walked in, and I didn't know who it was. And I'm like, hey, I'm Jeff Campbell. And he says, hi, I'm John Patitucci. And I'd devoured the Chick Corea Electric Band record with him and Dave Weckl in the 80s, even though I'm not much of a fusion cat these days. But I know talent when I see it. Yeah. And so I was like, wow, John Patitucci, you know. So I tried playing it cool. And we were doing some really goofy jingle, you know, probably never got picked up. But the thing that was so funny about it, I remember, is that all of a sudden the composer slash producer says, and it was kind of a difficult thing, and he says, hey, can we try this at double speed? And I just remember chuckling myself saying, you probably have the only guy in New York on bass right now. It was, yeah, sure, no problem. He's a very nice cat. And, you know, for people that don't know him, he is a master of the bass.
Oh, God, yeah. And this one, man, this was blew my mind because I thought you were too young. Sammy Davis Jr.
Yep. That was when I was in college in Miami. There was a in Sunrise, Florida, which is near Fort Lauderdale.
I used to live in Plantation, man. I know exactly where that is. It's, yeah, Sunrise, that is so funny.
Sunrise Musical Theater,
yeah,
where all the Vegas acts would come through.
Uh-huh.
I played with Sammy and Mitzi Gaynor and Billy Eckstein, Henny Youngman, Don Rickles.
Oh,
it was all the Vegas acts came through. And they would, you know, what's the word I want to use? They would hire the musicians from University of Miami to come be in the band. And Sammy typically toured with the rhythm section, but he had recently fired his guitar player. So I got the call. You know, I was 19 maybe, you know, totally green. And at the time, I like Sammy Davis Jr. Vegas. I learned very quickly that guy heavyweight. Now I look back and how I listened to the Rat Pack and all that stuff in Sinatra, and Sammy was the man. And he'd play all the instruments. He played drums. He played trumpet. He danced. It was unbelievable how talented the guy was. But I did a week with Sammy, and the story I love to tell it, his big number at the end of the show was Mr. Bojangles, which the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band tune, where he'd do his whole soft shoe thing in the spotlight. But it started with just guitar and him. And so here I'm, 19-year-old kid, trying to like lay down the groove. He had this musical director named George Rhodes, his name, big, imposing black man, and looked like a basketball player or something. So we're trying to do Mr. Bojangles at rehearsal. You know, it's a 40-piece orchestra, you know, string section, horn section, whole thing. And they're like, that doesn't feel right. Stop. So here's Sammy and George come over and lean over me. And I'm sitting there going, we got to get this feel right. And Sammy's saying to me, man, just feel like you're sitting on the front porch down in the bayou in Louisiana. Just relax. And, you know, and so I'm trying to get, it's in three. Boom, jenga, jenga, boom, jenga, jenga. And so, you know, I'm trying, but I'm 19, you know. I wish I could do it again for him. I think he'd like it today. But I learned very early on that feel is crucial. And but anyway, so they stopped the whole rehearsal. I got 40 people staring at me as they're leaning over me, trying to get me to get the feel. And I'm like, more like this? And they try something. They try something more like this. And they're finally like, that'll do. And then they just turn around and walk away.
So, did he say, hey, yeah, baby? Because isn't that his whole thing? He used to say that all the time.
Yeah, he was
dig it, baby. Yeah, he was like.
You know, and like I said, at the time, and I used to hide that credit because I felt like it dated me. But now I'm getting to the point where I don't really care. You know?
And that's the beauty of getting older, man.
Yeah. Digressing even a little bit more, the 6 degrees of separation, whatever. His bass player at the time was a guy named Al McKibben, who was a very famous older upright bass player. And he told me he used to play with Billie Holiday. So here I am playing with a cat on bass that played with Billie Holiday.
Holy, that's...
I know. So you get that 1 degree of separation.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, I know. So I was in over my head, but that was the opportunity that Miami gave me, you know.
And yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And, you know, and like I said, I did Don Rickles, Henny Youngman, Jerry Vale, all the, you know, the cheesy Vegas acts come through Florida to play for the retirees down there in South Florida.
I remember that now that you mentioned that. I hadn't thought about that in years. That's a Sunrise Musical Theater.
Sure. I think it's church now, I think, because it's all pre-internet. So I'll go on YouTube and try to find performances, but I think it's a church now.
Oh, really?
It's a bag of churches.
Man, let's talk about the book and your work with Sting. Again, the book is called Do Stand So Close, everybody listening. It's called Do Stand So Close, My Improbable Adventure as Sting's Guitarist. So the book is basically a rags to riches story. To riches, again. Yeah.
Well, maybe not riches, but redemption.
Yeah, redemption. Redemption. What prompted you to write it, and what were the biggest challenges in putting it together?
Well, it was funny because I've got all my itineraries from the tour, hard copies. And it's one of my most treasured keepsakes. It's in a leather-bound thing they gave me. It's got my name on the cover, and it's got – we did 181 dates. We did – it was about a year long. So that boils down to what, over 3 gigs a week for a year. Now people talk about, oh, yeah, we got a big tour coming up, 40 dates. I'm like, dude, we did 181. It was unbelievable. And so – one of my most treasured things is my itineraries. And I thought one day, you know, I always worried about fire or flood or whatever. I thought, I need to digitize every page of this. So I went and I had a big scrapbook as well. So I digitized every news clipping, every photo. I bought a new scanner, and it took me days to do it. But as I'm going through it, I thought, this is quite a story. And then that coupled with, I was talking to an old childhood friend one day, and I told him some anecdote. And he said, wow, you've never told me that story. And I thought, man, I've been telling these stories for years. I need to try to see if I can assemble them. And I truly, when I put pen to paper or fingers to laptop keyboard the first day, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I was like, I don't know what this is. I never took an English or journalism class or writing class in college. And I thought, I don't know. Is this 30 pages of stuff? I don't know. And I just started writing. And my naivete was my blessing because now if somebody says I'm going to write a book, I'm like, you better think about that before you try. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. It took me 5 years to write it. The first draft was about 5 or 6 months. And then I sat down and read it. And I told my wife, I said, this has all the charm of a grocery list. We did this. I did this. We did this. And so, I got a lot of advice from people along the way, but one thing I always kept in mind, I said, writing is putting words on paper. Editing them is making them not shitty.
Editing is the killer, man.
So I wrote for 5 months, then I edited for 4.5 years.
But you got a big book, man. It's just, I just looked at it. It's 312 pages.
Yeah. But not to scare the readers away.
No. It's a 6x9. Right. It's 3.5 pages. Right. It's 6x9. It's well spaced. It's really easy read.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I based it. Essentially, there's a quick little beginning and a quick ending, but it's basically like going on the tour. It's kind of a journal of the tour. It's not got chapters. It's got anecdotes from various gigs, but I've laid out every gig we played because I'm trying to build up the kind of the fatigue of going, turn the page. Well, look, there's 6 more dates, you know. It's like, I mean, we were playing, like I said, anywhere from 4 to 6 shows a week probably. And, so I wanted to lay it out like a journal, almost like an oral history of that year on the road. And then again, the kind of the reality that settled in when I came home. And, but it, you know, I was inspired to write it. It was much harder than I ever thought. I say in the back of the book, it was kind of like swimming across the ocean. You get about halfway across and you go, well, I can't turn around. So you just keep going. There were times where I thought, once I really, it's like doing the world's biggest Rubik's Cube as you're trying to solve and explain situations to people that weren't there. And you know, you were there, so you remember it, but to use the correct,
they weren't there. So you've got to be expanded and clear enough. Yeah.
But at the same time, try to be really concise. And so I worked really hard. I joked. I said, I'm trying to write a page turner, not an eye roller. And I think I succeeded.
I've had
a few people write me and say, I read the book start to finish. They say, I stayed up all night, but I couldn't put it down because it is a roller coaster ride of, wow, I can't believe this happened. And there's all kinds of crazy things that happened. But I had my hat is off to anybody that's ever written a book. And it's an amazing journey. And it was very cathartic for me. And it's also, you know, I didn't do it for money. Thank God. I play guitar for money. So I wrote for the legacy aspect of it and the catharsis. So it's like leaving something to me. I don't have children, but I do like to think that 50 years from now, one of my great nephews will read this book and go, wow, that was crazy. So it was fun to do that.
Did you have to get clearance like from Sting or management or anybody?
I did not. I was first of all, it's not, I don't,
It's not a tell-all. No,
it's not at all. It's a tell song.
It's about you.
It's a love letter to Sting. That guy changed my life incredibly. It is a love letter to Sting. I was told early on from a legal standpoint, anybody that's a public figure, you can talk about them. If you start talking about individuals, private individuals, you have to get their permission. So everybody I talk about in the book is kind of a public figure. So I don't have to go ask Eric Clapton or Bruce Springsteen if I can put their name in a book, you know, because they're and again, early on when I was looking for publishers, I think certain publishers were hoping that I was going to really dish the dirt on Sting.
And these people are stupid. And I was they're always,
you know, first of all, if I had the dirt to dish, which I wouldn't do it anyway, because that's not what it's about. But, you know, it's about a small town kid coming of age, getting thrown in the deep end of showbiz and how he tries to survive it and the stupid things he does and the smart things he does. And it's really a coming of age thing. And again, the rags to riches to rags part, whereas even when I was trying to find publishers and they were like, well, your fan base isn't large enough. I said, if I'd become famous, this would be a different story.
Yeah.
Famous people memoirs are this. I struggled, then I succeeded.
Yeah.
Mine is I succeeded, then I struggled again.
Yeah.
And it's that Shakespearean arc that I think makes my book compelling, makes my life, you know, the ups and downs. But really, everybody's life is that way. I'm not saying everybody's life is easy. But the fact that I ended up coming back from going around the world with Sting and playing at catering halls in the Bronx, there's a cautionary tale in there.
Absolutely, man. Let me ask you some questions. The first time you guys were in Europe, it turned into a disaster. I was wondering if you could share that story and talk about what you did after the fiasco.
Well, the thing that you're probably referred to in my book is, and this is the way I got the Sting gig. I auditioned for people because people always, that's another reason why I wrote the book. People say, how the hell did you end up on that gig? You'd been in New York 8 months. Why did Sting hire a guy that nobody's ever heard of? What happened was, is when I first came to New York, I put out some feelers and a friend of mine who I knew from North Carolina contacted some of his friends and introduced me to a keyboard player named Delmar Brown. And at the time, Delmar, he's from Chicago. And he had a fusion band called Bush Rock, but he was also the synthesis in the Gil Evans Orchestra, which was a big downtown. They played at Sweet Basil's down on 7th Avenue South every Monday. And Gil's orchestra was Hiram Bullock on guitar and Randy Brecker and on trumpet, you know, Danny Gottlieb on drums, Mark Egan on bass, Pat Metheny's rhythm section or whatever. So Gil's thing, and Gil was well known as a jazz arranger for Miles Davis. He did Sketches of Spain and a couple other records, I think. So Gil was a well-known arranger. But anyway, I auditioned for Delmar's band, Bush Rock, and did not get the gig. But then the guitar player that did get the gig quit because he said, this looks a little shaky to me. So I get a phone call from Delmar saying, I'm already in France. Will you come join me in France? I need you on guitar. So I fly over to Europe, you know, finances be damned, to join his band. Because he's there doing the jazz festival circuit with the Gil Evans Orchestra. So Delmar's like, I'm going to get some money together and take my band along. So every town Gil's orchestra goes to, I'm going to take my band and we're going to play somewhere. So I'm in Delmar's little ensemble kind of piggybacking around with the Gil Evans Orchestra. And the money did get funny. So that's the disaster you speak of. My paycheck stopped. So, but I didn't care. I'd never been to Europe and I was selling candy in Broadway theaters. So I was like, but the happy ending is at the Umbria Jazz Festival in Italy, there's a big performance by Gil Evans featuring Sting. And because on Sting's new album, Nothing Like the Sun, he had done a cover version of the Jimi Hendrix tune Little Wing that Gil had arranged. Gil was known for taking a big band and doing Jimi Hendrix tunes and stuff. He's kind of, you know, eccentric. And so Sting and Gil Evans were collaborators and they did a performance together in Italy. So I'm there. And so the fusion band's playing this dive bar in Italy and Sting came to see the show. So that's how I got on his radar.
And he liked what he saw.
Well, he came to see Delmar because he knew Delmar from Gil Evans Orchestra. And he said, I'll come out to that club and see your band play. So he comes to this little dive bar. We're playing in Perugia, Italy. And then the tour falls apart. The disaster, as you say, my paycheck stopped. I stumble home and start selling candy again. And then like 2 months later, the phone rings and Delmar says, "Hey, Jeff, Sting's looking for guitar players. And he asked me about you." And the rest is history.
Amazing, so, man.
So,
wow.
And we were like three guys to a hotel room and the bathroom down the hall and didn't have enough money to eat. You know, it was doozy. But,
and then Sting's gig, you're doing private jet, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. All of a sudden, I'm back in Paris and I'm staying in the nicest hotel there as opposed to three guys in a hostel somewhere. So,
and I'm sure you weren't missing that.
No, definitely not.
It's funny, like there's a benefit to going through that, but once you're done, it's nothing because I've been there in my life. Once it's done, it's like nothing you fucking want to revisit.
Well, that's a good friend of mine, a piano player who's he plays with Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes, but he's played with Bon Jovi and done a lot of different things. But his name's Jeff Kazee, and Jeff has this theory. He says the good gigs come from the knucklehead gigs, and he's right.
Yeah.
You take the knucklehead gig and you meet somebody, and because the established players will not take the knucklehead gigs. And now I find myself in that part of my life, like you just said. It's like I go, you know, it's the young kids that are hungry that will go to Europe for a few hundred dollars.
Yeah.
That they're going to meet somebody that's going to turn into a great gig. But, you know, you don't want to keep paying dues forever. So, no. Yes, the Bushrot gig was my knucklehead gig that led to the big gig.
That's great. So your first gig for Sting. So were you just about the audition? Were you like nervous or how did that go down outside of him telling you how to miss, you got to keep missing work from selling candy?
Yeah, right. Well, that's, you know, I talk about it in the book. I don't, and this is not self-deprecation, this is just calling strikes and balls. I'm not the most talented guy, so my superpower is over preparing. I try to be as prepared as possible. So I found out I had an audition. I had 1 week, so I learned every Police tune, every Sting tune I could get my hands on.
That's a huge fucking catalog,
well,
man.
He had five Police records, I think, but I just, you know.
Yeah, but those aren't like GCD, man.
Yeah, right.
Those,
yeah, so you know. I'm not saying I knew him back, you know, cold, but I was familiar with every Police tune and Sting's Blue Turtles record. He only had one solo record out at the time. And the first day we went to the audition, and I thought it was going to be a cattle call of guitar players, but it wasn't. It was just me and my friend Delmar on keyboards, bass and drums and percussion. And we just sat there and played tunes. And I was like, wow, this is not at all what I thought it was going to be. And Sting just kept calling tunes. And, you know, I talk about it in the book. I said, clearly my friends weren't compelled to learn every Sting song under the sun like I'd been. So he'd say, "You guys know this one?" And they'd shrug. And I go, "Yeah, I know it." And then you go, "Well, what about this one? We're looking for stuff to play." And he kept calling tunes. And I kept saying yes. And finally he turned and looked at me and said, "Jeff, stop showing off." And then I went home and I thought, okay, well, that was the end of that. It was a fun day, back to the real world. And a day later, I got a phone call saying, "Sting wants to know if you can come back down to the rehearsal studio tomorrow." And then I went for three more straight days. And on the fourth day, he hired me.
So he was just joking when he said, "Stop showing off."
Oh, yeah. No, he wasn't angry. He had a twinkle in his eye for sure. He's like, "Stop showing off."
Okay. You know? Okay.
And I was like, and I thought, well, I made an impression one way or the other here.
Yeah.
But I had learned every tune. And I was kind of almost the archivist. You know, we'd be in, when we were putting the tour together, they'd be like, "Jeff, how's the bridge go on, you know, this tune or that?"
And every
tune,
little thing she does is magic.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
I love that, man. My superpower is over preparing. I love that, man. That's great.
You know, I think there's a classic quote, and it, of all people, Calvin Coolidge, the president, said it. And I don't know it verbatim, but the gist of it is he said, "History is littered with talented derelicts. Talent is nothing without work." And he said, "Perseverance is what gets you there."
Yeah.
Talent without work, you know, it'll carry you a certain place. But I think hard work can beat talent most of the time.
Yes.
Now, my theory is when you get talent and work ethic, witness Prince, Michael Jackson, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, you go, that's where we get the icons. Because they have the God-given talent and they know how to work hard. But I've met a lot of really talented people that are kind of lazy because they're used to things coming easy for them. I don't think of myself as being that talented, so I work really hard. My book's an example of that. I thought, wow, this is real. People say, "You're a gifted writer." I go, "No, I'm not. It's 99% elbow grease. I kept working on it until it sounded like a real
book." Yeah,
gifted
writer. It took me 4.5 years to edit that. Right. They don't want to hear that, man.
No. I read a quote one time that I love. It said, to excel, you have to be prepared to work without applause. And I think about that all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's like,
you got to do a lot of work without any pats on the back to get to that moment in the sun.
Yeah, it's a grind. Shit's a grind to get till it gets up and moving.
Yeah. And then you're an overnight success.
Right. How that works, right?
Yeah.
Is that like that? Wasn't that? That's from that quote, the man in the arena, isn't it?
Oh, I did another podcast and we talked about the same thing, the man in the arena. And that's what I said. I admire the people that will get in the arena and
get this dirty. Other podcast.
They said, what inspires you? I said, people that try. I don't give a damn whether you succeed or fail. I care if you try. Because I do not want to be one of those guys sitting on a bar stool saying, I could have done this. I could have done that.
Oh, my God.
It's like, you bore me to death, man. Where's your book? Where's your song? Write something. You know, and it's like, so yes, the man in the arena. It's like, success is a lot of factors. There's a book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. I don't know if you've ever read it.
I have not read it.
He talks about, it's interesting because he talks about all these factors that go into success that are beyond your control.
Yes.
For example, in my case, my gig with Del Mar Brown's Bushrock that got me in front of Sting in a club in Italy, it only occurred because the guitar player they hired quit. Now, how could I control that guy?
I mean, you can't.
So when you look at successful people, I read that Bill Gates, he grew up next door to a guy who worked at Hewlett Packard. So he brought home computer parts for him to play with.
So, yeah. If his neighbor had been a garbage man.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So my point being is, it's not about succeeding. You can't look at success or failure and say, you have to look at the effort. And that's what I'm always about. You know,
I talk about this a lot. Because it boggles my mind. And I think, and I'm a very practical guy. I'm from the Bronx and I don't usually think like this. And I've said it on the show several times. Having been a consultant for over 20 years and work with hundreds of clients and individuals and my own life. And there is a question mark, you know, call it God, call it the universe. If you're doing something and the universe supports it, you're going to succeed. If you're doing that same thing 6 months later, the universe may not support it for whatever reason. You're going to fail.
Right.
You know,
I agree.
And it's so
timing. Yeah. You know, and again, that's what Gladwell talks about, even to like athletes being born at a certain time of the year makes them biggest in the class. And so they get more attention on the athletic field. So if you're born in August, as opposed to February, you have more of an opportunity. So you can't control when you're born.
No.
So, you know, at a certain point you just let go and see what happens. But I talk about it at the very beginning of my book, you know, I've always heard luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And that's what happened to me. I worked my ass off. And then the stars aligned and an opportunity fell in my lap and I was able to execute.
And man, sometimes when you're in that zone, you can't mess up. I'll never forget. I'm not a gambler, but we go to Vegas once every 4 or 5 years. We play a little bit of blackjack, right? I mean, we take $100 and if we lose half, we're like, okay, we're done. But I was out and I was just winning everything. And it was such a zone that I got two tens and I motioned for a hit and they dealt me an ace.
Wow.
That's the zone I was. That has never happened in my life. Well, I mean, but that's been my observation, man. When you're doing the right thing, it's like, you know.
Right. And I always think about the Sinatra tune, That's Life. Riding high in April, shot down in May, back on top in June.
You know? There you go, man.
That's life.
So then, man, your first gig for Sting is in Rio de Janeiro. The crowd is over 200,000 people. What's going through your mind like when you're feeling, you know, the power of what I assume is more wattage and more cabinets behind you than you ever had before? And then you're looking out in front of you and you're seeing like 200,000 people. What's.
Well, to the best that I can remember, I mean, it's funny. I look at video footage from that and I don't even. The guy I see holding the guitar, I don't remember him. It's like out of body experience or something. I don't know. I look at that guy and go, I can't access that. But intellectually, I do remember feeling overwhelmed by just the sheer number of people. It's like going to a New Year's Eve in Times Square or a ticker tape parade. It's like all those people around, it gets kind of scary, you know? And I talk about in the book, not to digress, but people say, was it scary playing in front of those large crowds? I go, hell no, it was scary playing in front of Sting.
Yeah.
You know, it was the eight people on stage, Branford Marsalis and Kenny Kirkland looking over at you going, come on, dude, let's do this. You know, so it was the eight people on stage that were scary, not the 100,000 people or whatever. You know? But in South America, again, I had never been off the eastern seaboard of the United States. My entire life had been spent between North Carolina, Miami, Florida, and New York City. I mean, by the time I got to LA, I'd already been to Rio and Paris and London. And, you know, I was like, oh, here's California. You know, so, and, you know, and we're out on the road and Kenny Kirkland had been around, already done one Sting tour. And I joke in the book about it. Kenny would say, every time we'd land somewhere, he'd be like, Jeff, you ever been here before? And I'd be like, dude, I've never been anywhere before. I mean, every town I got to, it was like, wow, you know, welcome to Las Vegas. Welcome to Chicago. Welcome to New Orleans. I'd never seen these
places.
That's
really cool, man.
But back to your question about the amplification, we were using wedge monitors, no in-ears, and it was pretty loud on stage, but I had a wireless guitar, and I do remember one time as the tour grew and we got more adventurous, you know, I'd run around the stage and get a little more, you know, demonstrative, and I made the mistake of stepping in front of the main speaker stack while I was playing guitar. And it almost stopped my heart. It was so loud standing right in front of those speakers. And I think there's a video of it out there somewhere. You see me, the spotlights follow me, and I get in front of the mains, and I quickly go back into the stage.
Where is that? I'm going to watch that video.
I think it might be in Japan. Is it in Japan? It might not be. I think it's Little Wing, because that was my big number in the Sting tour. And again, back to the elements of success. If Sting doesn't decide to cover the Jimi Hendrix tune, maybe he doesn't hire a guitar player. I don't know.
Wow.
And one quick note, before we went on the road, we did Saturday Night Live. We did the season premiere of Saturday Night Live. And I detail this a lot in my book, but we were originally going to play We'll Be Together and Be Still My Beating Heart, which was the first two singles off of Nothing Like the Sun. And one day we're at rehearsal and we play like a 10-minute version of Little Wing and, you know, just rocking out. And we stop and everybody's staring at each other and Sting goes, you think we can get that down to 4 minutes? And we're all dying laughing. Because on SNL, you could only play 4 minutes. So right. You had to cut off. And so Sting goes, screw it. We're going to play Little Wing on Saturday Night Live. So his complete last minute audible, I went from just being the rhythm guitarist on two tunes to having to, if you watch the, it's hard to find.
I actually saw that clip, as a matter of fact.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, I went from being just anonymous sideman to having a total feature on Little Wing. And one other little side note, again, because it was the Gil Evans Orchestra on the record, guitarist Hiram Bullock playing on the record. Mm. So when we do Saturday Night Live, guess who shows up to the show?
Hiram Bullock. Yeah.
And sits on the front row and crosses his arms and looks at me like, dude, this better be good. Cause it, you know, Hiram wanted the gig.
Yeah.
I talked about it in the book.
Very cool, man. Talk about the value of having people skills and how this impacted you and what you learned from this.
Well, without giving too many spoilers, and I'll try to cut to the chase. About a month into the tour, I found out that Sting had actually auditioned some other guitarists. His manager, Miles Copeland, was not a fan of Jeff Campbell. So all of a sudden, I find out we're in London after we do South America right before Christmas. Sting was secretly looking at other guitarists on because his management wanted him to make a change.
From you?
Yeah, from me. I didn't know this at the time. I was running around London in Christmas holiday bliss, you know, and then I find out a month later, oh, he looked at other guitar players in London, but he didn't make a change. And I talk about that in the book. I go, there's no doubt in my mind, if I was a jerk, I would have been gone. Sting liked me, so he kept me. And the quote I use in the book, I remember there used to be a show on VH1 called Behind the Music. Mm. And it was Huey Lewis in the news, and they were interviewing his road manager, and his road manager said, I don't care how good you play. If you're an asshole, I don't want you on the bus. And I've always thought about that. It, you know, the playing is a very small part of it. You know, it's about getting along with people. And it's hard to go home and practice being likable. You know,
I'm not
you need to be more likable. You know, but maybe it's like
you can't sit in the mirror and work on that, man.
Right, right. But you can try to, you know, put yourself in other people's shoes, be, you know, just sensitive to other people and all that, and get it plays well with others. I don't know, you know, but that was the people skills, you know, because again, we were only making music 2.5 hours a night. We were on the road 24 hours a day. You're on the plane together. You're on the bus together. You're in the hotel together. You're eating together. And, you know, getting along with people is important. Bring, as a friend of mine says, bringing a positivity to this situation, you know.
And that's harder to do the younger you are.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's good upbringing, you know, thanks to my parents.
Yeah.
I had two brothers, so I'd learned how to share early on. And my parents taught me the value of, you know, honesty and, you know, ethics and integrity. And they instilled that in me. And I guess it you know, it helps.
That's great, man. Mm-hmm. In the book, you talked about diving headfirst into hedonistic Los Angeles with loud rock and roll, mediocre tennis, sordid sexcapades, a borrowed red Ferrari, and lots of drinking. I was wondering, can you share a story about that?
Well, I remember seeing an interview with Greg Allman after his memoir or his biography came out.
What a great book, man.
It's a great book. You feel like you're sitting in a bar talking to him, and that's what people have said about my book.
Yes.
And because they say, I can really hear you there. And I say to people, well, I'm not famous enough to have a ghostwriter, because a lot of these things are, you know, the artist will sit down and be interviewed for 100 hours, then the writer does the book. Every word in the book is mine. Nobody wrote it. So it really is my voice. But I saw an interview with Greg, and they kept asking questions. He finally said, just read the book. So to answer about Ferraris and sexcapades and tennis, there's a lot of tennis bumps on the tour. So there's all these stories in there about driving Ferraris and ending up in compromising situations. And there's no gratuitous sex or drugs in the book, but I do, you know, there are situations where I'm not going to sanitize what was going on. So, but it's in there. But the one thing I think about that always sticks out in my mind about Los Angeles is we played the Forum, which was the big venue at the time. It was before the Staples Center was open. So LA Forum, where the Lakers played. Mm-hmm. And I talk about this in the book. And, you know, we've been on the road for a couple of months at that point and pretty full of ourselves. And, you know, and this, and so after the show, we're in the green room for the, you know, this, you know, after party, whatever you want to call it, the reception. And I'm seeing all these Hollywood stars there. And I'm going, you know what? They're here to see me. You know, it's about us. It's not about them. And I look over and Quincy Jones is standing in the room and I just melted. I was like, oh my God, there's Quincy. Cause I love Ray Charles. I love Frank Sinatra. I love Michael Jackson. And to me, Quincy is the master. Yeah. He is the king.
Brilliant. You know?
And so I was like, I've got to meet Quincy Jones. So, I see Branford Marsalis start talking to Quincy, and I march right over and say, Branford, introduce me to Quincy Jones. So it was like, it was just so cool to be in that, you know, environment. And, you know, I mentioned in the book, I said, the only celebrity, and again, I ended up hanging out with Clapton and Springsteen and all those guys, but Quincy had me more starstruck than anybody else I met. I mean, I was a total giddy fan, and I don't care, because, you know, whether it's Sinatra Live at the Sands, which I think is the greatest record ever made that Quincy did the arrangements with the Count Basie Orchestra. I always tell people when they say you're stuck on a deserted island with one album, what's it going to be? I say Sinatra Live at the Sands with the Count Basie Orchestra. It's Sinatra's 50th birthday in Vegas. And what a party it is. What a great record. And those are Quincy's arrangements. So all the way from that to Off the Wall with Michael Jackson, I'm like, I don't know if you've seen the Quincy documentary.
I was just going to mention that to you. It's phenomenal.
Unbelievable.
And I had no idea what he was responsible for and how talented he was before I watched that, to be honest with you. I learned a lot.
The thing at the end with Ray Charles at the Kennedy Center singing to him just stunned me. It was so good. So anyway, it's all in the book, as Greg Allman says. But yes, meeting Quincy in L.A. was a highlight.
At one point in time, as the tour keeps going on, your own behavior, your drinking and drugs began to compromise some of your work. If you're comfortable, can you talk about some of that and how and when you wound up getting past this? Again, only if you're comfortable. If you're not, that's
cool. I'm happy to talk about it. My addictions and my sobriety are a big part of my book. Growing up in the South in the 60s and the 70s, drinking was just a coming of age. That was a rite of passage. So, and again, like I said, I started playing fraternities when I was 13 and kegs of beer. And, you know, so I started drinking early on, and that was when that's how you became a man. You drank. Mm. So I had a taste for alcohol long before I ended up out on the road. But, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you're bored, you're lonely, you're tired. And even moving to New York was a big thing for me because I got here and I realized that the bars opened at 8 a.m. I was like, I never heard of such a thing.
And they do not close.
No, they lock the door at 4, but they don't throw you out. You know, you're sitting there with prostitutes and cops at 5, 6 a.m. So if you're a friend of mine, somebody came to New York, says nobody gets thirsty in this town, do they?
Yeah.
So I always had a taste for alcohol. My drug thing is kind of minimal, really. I always felt like drugs were just something that helped me drink more. So booze was definitely my drug of choice. Mm. And I discussed that in the book as going, because every country you go to, there's booze. You know,
yes.
You get caught with some drugs in Japan, kiss your butt goodbye. But Japan's bars are stocked full. So lots of drinking and just kind of the entitlement of becoming, quote unquote, famous and all that. And it got out of hand. And when I came back to New York and reality hits, and again, it's in the book, it's like I had to get sober. It was compromising my health. But on the road, you know, Sting gave us a wide berth. And, you know, I talk about one gig in the book where I got really drunk and I was on stage being a total jerk and all that. And he let me go and didn't say anything. We're just burned out. We'd been in Europe for like 3 months or something like that. And as I point out in the book, 3 months in Europe uninterrupted with no internet, you might be on the day old newspaper to figure out if who won the Yankees game. You know, there was no real time sports. There was no email. There was no FaceTiming with your girlfriend. I mean, it was a phone. There was a telephone and that was it. And a day old USA Today. So it was really brutal over there. So, you know, you start self-medicating to an extreme out of boredom and loneliness and all that. But the one gig I always tell about in the book, it's like I drank too much, was kind of sloshing around the stage all night. And at the end of the night, when Sting introduces the band, he goes, and on guitar, most of Jeffrey Lee Campbell.
Wow. That's really good that, you know, he was that good spirited about it.
I address it in the book. He understood the fragility. And he was very good at sparing the rod. And, you know, he was a great band leader to work for. Very generous and very – he was empathetic. I mean, he was cool. He didn't crack the whip. He just hired good guys and let them do their thing, you know. So,
and how long after you came back to the city did you get sober?
3 years later, maybe. I mean, I really went off the deep end once I come back to town, and that's kind of the scariest part of the book is post-Sting, where I come back
about that.
With a ton of money in my bank account. I'm single. I get an apartment in Hell's Kitchen, and I just party around the clock, you know, just blowing through my money, thinking, I'm not going to do any small gigs. There'll be another big gig coming up, you know. And then all of a sudden, I kind of realize, wow, I'm out of money, and I have a bad drinking problem. And, you know, in very simple terms, I met my wife, fell in love, and I continued to drink. But, you know, with her, it became, you know, a friend said to me one time, he said, look, drinking is a full-time job. Being married is a full-time job. It's that job. He says, who wants three jobs?
And that's great. Nobody. That is great advice, man.
Yeah. So drinking was a full-time job. And being a good husband was a full-time job. And then I was trying to work as a musician. So after I got married, I quickly realized the drinking's got to stop. And my health was compromised. I address, go into detail in the book, but I have some health issues because of excessive drinking. So,
well, good for you that you recognize it on your own, man.
Yeah, you know, I had to be hit over the head a couple of times. But God finally said, dude, I'm not giving you but so many chances here. So.
That's the way addiction works, man. It's usually not a little whisper that says, oh, man, you know, I think I need to take care of this shit, you know.
No,
that's why they call it rock bottom, you know. Right.
But there's some near misses where it was like, should I get sober? Nah, maybe not. I dodged another bullet here. But it's not – and it's funny, as an aside – writing my book, I kept early on, I was like, I want to get other people's input. And I did have a lot of people read it as I was writing it. And a friend had said, he said, you know, you got to write the book that you want to write because everybody's going to have an opinion. He said, if you get a mandate and you hear the same thing from 10 people, maybe you ought to address it. But it's funny. I wrote the book and one person read it and said, I love it that it's not about addiction. And then another person said, I wish it had more addiction in it. It's not a book about addiction. This is not another getting sober book. This is about going around the world with a rock star
getting thrown in the deep end of showbiz. It, you know, I deal with some drinking and sobriety in it, but it's a very small part of it. I did, this is not a 12-step book. This is a rags to riches rock star book. You know,
I'm just travel happy, log. I'm just happy you got sober though, and you're feeling better though.
Yeah. Well, it's been over 24 years.
Good for you, man. Sobriety. That's awesome. Congratulations. That's fucking great.
Sober in New York, you get sober anywhere.
That's right. Yeah, man. You got temptation on every. Oh my God. Yeah, that's right. Change your people, places, and things. Good luck with that, man. Man, if you had to go back today and assuming you were open to it, give advice to younger Jeffrey Lee Campbell, what advice would you have given? Career wise, personal, life wise, anything?
Those are actually very easy. Cool out on the drinking and the partying. I mean, I didn't see it. You know, I should have just pulled back. I just should have tried to use some moderation early on. But I talk about it in my book. I dropped out of college. I had a 3.9 grade point average. I learned every Police song and Sting song. Moderation is not my strong suit. I'm either off or on. You know, it's like, and I think to achieve things, you have to kind of be obsessive, you know. Go ask Tiger Woods how many golf balls he's hit, you know.
Well, so. The other thing is, and I know you're aware of this, is you're obviously intellectually gifted and bright, and those are the toughest people to get sober.
Right.
Because you've always got an intellectually appealing reason why it's not the right time.
Sure.
You could convince yourself of your own bullshit.
Well, and also I think I'm a sensitive person, which it helps me in music, but that self-medicating is great for your sensitivity. I find that more sensitive people I know are the people that end up needing some kind of thing to take the edge off. So that's that. But back to the two pieces of advice, A, don't drink so much. B, ear training. Learn how to hear things. There's an anecdote in the book where Sting's asking everybody to come up with a background vocal part, and I can't hear it because my ears are not good enough, and I didn't practice singing enough. I grew up, and you see, you know, I've learned that good singers work on their craft like every other instrumentalist, but I have seen there is a certain amount of God-given gift with singing. You know, I've seen people that have never taken a lesson in their life open their mouth and sound beautiful. Mm. I've never seen somebody pick up a trumpet and sound beautiful the first time they tried to blow through it. No. You know, so,
yes.
So there's something that's different here.
Point. Yeah, that's a you very know? Good so point.
I'm not slagging singers, but I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So I grew up thinking, wow, singing, either you got it or you don't. Because I had friends that could open their mouth and sound good, and I didn't. And now I look at it more like, no, it's an instrument like everything else. I should have practiced. I made it never sound like Steve Perry or Stevie Wonder, but learn how to sing in tune, learn how to hear. I wish my college education had been much more focused on ear training, you know. And I think as young players, we get obsessed with technique and we're practicing, oh, I got to get faster. No, if you can turn on a song without the instrument in your hand, but just a pen and a piece of paper and write down what the chord progression was. Maybe I've seen a good friend of mine, John Harrington, who's been playing guitar with Steely Dan for 15 years. I saw John transcribing with the cassette player in one hand and the pen in the other. I mean, if you start playing a melody for me, I got to pick up my guitar and try to hunt and peck to find. But John, and he said he just came home every day after school, dropped the needle on the vinyl and did ear training. So my advice to younger Jeff, work on your ears. Be able to hear the third of the chord, be able to hear the fifth of the chord, be able to hear that the bridge just modulated up a fourth, you know, as opposed to, you know, using what the left side of the brain is the analytical side of the brain, right?
I think, yeah.
Turn off the left brain. And I talk about it in my book. Branford's ears are so huge, he can hear anything. And I just envy people like that. And I think people, you've seen the kid on YouTube that the guy can play anything on the piano and the kid knows every note. Clearly the kid was born with some kind of wiring that allows him to do that. But I think your ears can be, even if you don't have perfect pitch or anything like that, it can be improved. And so I would say, and I think if you hear it and sing it, it connects in your head on the right brain kind of thing. So my advice was, boy, work on my ear training, turn off the metronome and do more transcribing, you know, that kind of thing.
Very cool, man. Are you a rule breaker or a rule follower? by nature?
Rule follower, big rule follower. Yeah. I had a revelation a couple of years ago. I was on a gig. We do these corporate gigs for like law firms, and we kind of called it the Sidemen to the Stars gigs, where we'd assemble these all-star sidemen and go play classic rock covers for law firms or whatever. And I'm looking around, and there's Billy Joel's guitarist or Billy Joel's sax player or Bon Jovi or Southside's keyboard player. And I'm looking at these guys, and they're like kicking over monitors and jumping around and smiling and singing. And I go, those guys are cowboys. And I said, I realize I am not a cowboy. I'm a sheriff. I kind of break it down into cowboys and sheriffs, and I'm very law and order, which is what the studio appeals to me.
Yeah.
The Broadway pit appeals to me. Lots of constraints.
Control and
repetition.
Yeah.
Whereas I got friends that would slit their wrists if they had to play a Broadway show night after night, but they'll go on the road and play rock and roll and wing it, and they're in their element. They couldn't be happier. And I've realized over time that I am definitely a rule follower. I like law and order. A friend of mine says, the chaos of live music drives him crazy, and I'm kind of the same way. It's very chaotic, whereas yeah. some people thrive on that. You know, I just read a quote last week, Wayne Shorter, saxophone's weather report, of course, but he said when he played with Miles, he said, I played with Miles for 6 years. We never rehearsed. We never talked about music. How can you rehearse the unknown? Those guys would just get on stage and say, here's what it is.
Right.
And meanwhile, I'm the guy that I want to know. I don't like surprises.
You want to know every change coming up. And
I think that's the type A personality and the alcoholism and all that stuff all mixed in there together. And I'm clear that, you know, that's an asset and a liability at the same time. And you just try to use it for good instead of evil.
Yeah.
Definitely a rule follower. I mean, I like things. I like Prince had a song called Joy in Repetition, and I get that. And that's just me. I can play an E9 chord for 12 minutes and be totally happy.
Tommy Burns, are you talking about Tommy Burns?
Tommy.
I interviewed Tommy. Yeah.
And Tommy is a cowboy. We were doing this gig, and we were supposed to play Back in Black by AC/DC. And we're like, okay, Back in Black. So Tommy digs into You Shook Me All Night Long, and he's killing it. We're like, wrong song, Tommy. You know, he's like, you look around like, oh yeah, we're supposed to be doing Back in Black. So, and he just got the biggest smile on his face and singing and jumping around. And I envy those cats, the guys that just, you know, everything is cool and laid back and go with the flow. But that's not me. I'm Mr. Overprepared.
That is a great asset, though, man.
It served me more than it's hurt me. And yeah, I do see that. Usually when people are telling me to relax, it's some guy who's out of work at that point in time or late for a gig or divorced. And I'm going, yeah, that relaxing thing. I see where that's gotten you.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah.
So, not, you know, to each his own. But I'm a detail-oriented guy, but it served me more than it's hurt me.
Who's had the biggest influence on your life, Jeff, as far as musically and personally?
Well, I mean, we have to set aside a separate category for our parents and our spouse, of course, because, you know, they're in the Hall of Fame. They're on Mount Rushmore of influences in your life. But so with that being said, I got to go with Sting. He changed my life. And again, that's a big part of the book. It's a love letter to a man who plucked me from obscurity and turned me in from being just another guy playing in wedding receptions and bars on guitar to seeing the world. And so Sting, absolutely, as far as changing my life, you draw a line through my life. There's pre-Sting and post-Sting. And I talk about it in the book. I mean, I'm 30 years out from that gig. You know what people ask me when they meet me? What was it like playing
Sting? Yeah, yeah. Has he read the book?
He, to my knowledge, has not.
You don't have his email. You can't say, hey, dude, I need you to read the book.
I approached him about writing the foreword, and he was in the middle of his tour with Shaggy and working on the last ship in Europe and all that. And he begged off, saying he was just too busy. And, you know, full disclosure here, I had a friend offer him a copy of the book. He says, I don't really like reading about my past.
Interesting.
And, but he did say, did Jeff treat me right in the book? And the friend said, yes, he portrays you definitely. Very nicely. Okay, that's good.
Definitely. So, Well, Sting, if you're the off chance you're listening at this, you know, call Jeff and read his book and write his forward. And then after you do that, call me and let's get you scheduled on my show.
A bit of self-promotion. I have sent the book to various people that were involved with the tour, and some have read it and some haven't. But Vic Garbarini, who had written the Sting tour program and at the time was the editor-in-chief for Musician Magazine, he also did Guitar World Magazine and was a music columnist for Playboy. And he recently reached out to me after I'd sent him a copy of the book and said, it's one of the best books on rock and roll I've ever read.
That's wonderful.
And he's written books on John Lennon and all that. And at the risk of patting myself on the back, because I had a couple of friends reach out to me. They said, oh, God, you sent me the book, and I was dreading reading it because people write terribly, and what am I going to say? And like I say, you know, my whole life giving people four-minute pop tunes. It's easier for people to listen to your four-minute pop tune.
Yeah.
You hand them a 84,000-word book and say, hey, let me know what you think. They're like, oh, I got homework. But I've had people call me and say, I was dreading reading it, and it was such a joy because I was right there with you every step of the way. So I did try to write a good beach read, airport read.
It's very conversational, man. No one's going to have a problem. It's anecdotal. It's really easy to digest.
You could almost read it out of order. You could open to the middle of the book, and it says August 25th, Paris, France. And then it tells a story that happened then. I don't advise that because you missed.
No, I wouldn't advise that either.
Because I had one friend who said, well, I'm a big Springsteen fan, so I just read all the parts about Springsteen. I was like, well, you're kind of missing the arc, young kid getting big gig, getting in over his head, surviving. You know, it can be read in bite-sized pieces, but there is a cautionary tale overarching kind of thing. So,
like Jeff, I apologize. I'm going to ask you three more questions.
Okay.
You mentioned your wife a few times. How'd you guys meet? How long have you been together?
We met in Hell's Kitchen. She's from Kentucky originally, but had moved to New York, and we just knew each other.
That's a story.
Yeah. She's from Kentucky. Did you guys know each other? I'm like, have you ever looked at a map? Kentucky, North Carolina?
It's down in the South. Come on, man.
You're from the South. You must know each other, right?
People in New York, you know what? Growing up there, I could see that easily being asked of you, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I've had people say that, and I remember a woman was cutting my hair one time, and she said, that Southern accent, are you from Texas? And I said, North Carolina. And she said the same thing. I said, you from Queens? She said, Brooklyn. You know, like
same
Queens
thing.
Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Now, Brooklyn and Queens are very different, but Texas and North Carolina are the same.
Same thing, man, of course. Yeah, it's this thing like south of Newark, it's all one.
Right. Well, there's that classic –
That New Yorker. Saul with it. Yeah, that's great. It's There's pretty Manhattan. Accurate.
Yeah, right. So I met her in New York, and we dated for a couple of years and got married.
How long y'all been together now?
Just celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary.
Dude, congratulations. That is awesome. That's really cool.
It's amazing. Yeah. For two people that can't even believe they're 25 years old, we're like, how can we be married 25 years?
Man, I've been with Ann. You know, I know exactly how you feel, man. It's weird.
Well, but we don't have any kids. You said you have kids. And a high school friend said to me one time, he said, you know, as you're yelling at your 16-year-old, you realize you're no longer 16. And she says, you start doing the math when you're looking at your kids and go, well, obviously I'm not as young as I think I am. And I say to people all the time, it's like, being a musician is arrested development anyway, because I'm still basically, I mean, I started gigging when I was 13 and I'm still doing it. And I kind of joke, I go, it's Johnny B. Good and A, you know, it's a gig. I've been doing the same thing basically since I was a young teen, and not ever having any children to turn me into the authority figure. I'm really confused about my age. You know, it's like, I don't know. I still feel like I'm in my 20s, you know, and
so
it's like, so, and that's what I'm saying. It's like, a friend of mine.
Look in the mirror.
I quote a friend in the book who said this, and I've always think about this. He said, rock and roll will kill you or cure you. You either die in your 20s, or when you're 80, you still feel like you're in your 20s. You know?
Which is great.
It's like, you know, it'll kill you or cure you. And for me and you, it's cured us.
Right.
Music, it is, like I said about Herbie Hancock, it is the fountain of youth.
Oh, my God.
It is the time machine, and it's the fountain of youth.
Well, I always, when I think of it now, is that like last night I was talking to my wife and I said, there was a picture on the wall or something. I said, oh man, we got that when we were kids. And I was like, Yeah, we were kids. That's a, I can't believe how long we've been together. It's a long time, you know, shit.
But that's what I'm saying. I got married in my 30s, and I thought I was old then. I moved to New York when I was 28, 27, and I thought I was old. And now I meet a 27-year-old and go, wow, I wish I was that young again. You know, people, somebody asked me the other day, how old were you when you were doing Sting? I said, I was 28. I had my 29th birthday on the road with him. We were in San Diego, but I was 28, and even I felt like the run of the litter.
Right.
I'm actually a year older than Branford Marsalis.
He's wow. That's interesting. Mm. He's always appeared older. I guess his the way he handles himself and the roles he's been in, you just assumed he was older.
Yeah.
Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music and writing?
I don't, and I think that's a big problem in my life, and I keep vowing to do that. And my brother and I discuss this a lot because, again, he's, like I said, doctored in music and been around the world with Harry Connick Jr. To excel at something, it becomes very, you know, single-minded. You know, you don't leave a lot of space for other stuff. You don't dabble to be excellent at something. Like I said, you know, there was an old Nike Tiger Woods commercial. He said, I don't hit golf balls on my days off. There are no days off, you know, and that's to achieve what and to continue to compete at the New York level. You don't really get to let your foot off the gas, you know. And so, but I have a good friend, a drummer, Joel Rosenblatt, who plays with Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Spyro Gyra. And he's like, hobbies are the key to your sanity. And I'm determined to figure this out. And I don't know if it's going to be, and I always joke to my wife, I'm like, I think I'll take up chess. And I said, but then I know what'll happen. I'll join a chess club, then I'll join the chess tournament, and I won't be happy till I win the chess tournament. You know, it's that kind of, you don't know how to take your foot off the gas and be moderate at something.
Don't join something to be excellent. Join it to have fun.
Right. Well, and that's what I was a lesson I learned many years ago. I'm the world's worst golfer and the worst tennis player. And I used to get so angry when I'd hit a ball in the woods or the water or knock a tennis ball and throw the club or throw the tennis racket. And then all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute, Jeff, you practice guitar every day. In my opinion, I barely play par guitar. So why do you think you can go hit a golf ball once a month and do any semblance of it good? So then I just had this liberating moment of like, no, you golf for the fresh air and the fun.
Right.
You play tennis for the fresh air and the exercise and the fun. So I do allow myself to suck at that, and it's very liberating.
Good.
So I have to pick something, whether it's fishing or cooking or whatever, and do it just for the love of it and allow myself to be very mediocre.
Yeah. But I do get that, though, because I have issues sometimes with performance. Like, I tend to be performance oriented, which is not good, which is like you just said, it's a blessing and a curse. So I totally get it. But there's like, I go to the gym. I've been doing this every, you know, 5 days a week for 25, 30 years now. And I'm so, when I was a kid, I went because I wanted to get muscles and look good for girls. Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, so grateful I do for my health, you know, and all I got to do is look at Facebook at the kids I went to high school with.
Sure.
And see that it's paid off.
Yeah, right. Sure. That's like living in New York, and I'm constantly working on really young people. It keeps the edge on. You know, you can't get sloppy. You know,
yeah, it's, man,
like there's always younger people coming up. But the thing about relaxing and learning to not be performance oriented, and the analogy I always use, it's like I always wonder about self-made men that become very wealthy. And it's like if you pinch pennies and ate canned soup and then you become a billionaire. You hear these stories about guys like that still fly coach because they're like, no, that's just the way I'm wired. And it's like asking somebody to be one way from age 10 to age 50 and then completely change the way they are. I don't know how realistic that is. So once you go down that road of trying to excel and achieve, it's kind of hard to just, but I think it's imperative, but I'm trying to learn. I'm determined to learn how to take my foot off the pedal and as they say, you're not a human doing, you're a human being.
Yeah.
Learn how to be a little bit more and not do so much all the time. But again, you know, there's no half-stepping in New York City because there's a guy that wants your gig, you know. So,
and for whatever it's worth, man, in my opinion, if you could get sober, you could do probably anything.
Yeah,
that's
right.
One of the, you know, you could beat an addiction. That is an incredibly difficult thing to do, man. So
that's what I tell people whenever I want to lose weight. I'm like, I can say no to French fries. You learn how to say no to vodka, you can say no to French fries.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, you know. Last question, Jeff. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been deliberate and intentional, and how much is just a part of aging?
Well, getting sober, of course, like I said, it's been almost 25 years, but that was deliberate because it was something that had to be done, just like getting in shape or losing weight or whatever. But what I see, and this probably happens with most people, as you get older, the humility really kicks into high gear because you realize how blessed you are, how lucky you've been. And you see surrounded by such talented people. And I realize, you know, we struggle with the imposter syndrome of thinking we're not good. And I tell people, I'm not trying to be self-deprecating. I just see some really talented people. And for me to have achieved what I've done, I'm very humbled by it. I talk about it in my book about getting pretty cocky at certain points on the Sting tour and then God teaching me some lessons in there. I mean, if you had given me a list of half of the things I've accomplished in my life when I was a teenager, said, you're going to do this, I'll take it. Where do I sign?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the day that Sting hired me, it's been gravy ever since then. Because who gets to play with Sting?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's some, it's one thing to go out on tour with band du jour or whatever, but there's only a few icons. And, you know, of course, Sting, well, again, we're talking 30 years out, but he was 2 years removed from the Police at that point. He was 2 years removed from Every Breath You Take at that point, where he was king of the hill. There's very little, you know, you won't find us on the Tonight Show or the Letterman Show because rock stars didn't do those shows back then. You did Saturday Night Live and that was it. So I miss that. I would have loved to have done David Letterman's show, but we were too big to do late night TV except for Saturday Night Live. And so again, it is not lost on me that, you know, it's one thing to go around the world with any recording artist, but somebody at the level of Sting, you know, like I said, that credit to this day gets me gigs because it boils. If you make it into the final cut, they go, let's go with the guy that Sting likes. So I've been very blessed. So the humility just kicks in. And at the risk of sounding like an old guy, but it is important, you start getting grateful about just being healthy. You start losing a lot of friends. And you go, hey, man. I mean, like I said, 20 years ago, I used to pray for gigs. Now I just pray for health. The gigs will take care of themselves, you know.
So I feel you, man.
If you stay healthy, you know, the gigs will come. And I've done more gigs than I deserve. I've been lucky. The one thing we haven't talked about, but is worth noting, I fell ass backwards into playing Mamma Mia on Broadway and it ran 14 years. Somebody called me up and said, hey, do you want to do this musical with ABBA songs in it? And I was like, yeah, I got nothing else better to do. I had no idea. And then Mamma Mia became later. 14 years. And I tell people, do the math. That's 52 paychecks a year times 14. Yeah, I mean, guitar players don't get that kind of, you don't get that kind of job security. You know, I talk about how Sting changed my life. Mamma Mia changed my life because I got a steady paycheck and I went straight from Mamma Mia into School of Rock. I've been at the Winter Garden Theater 15 of the last 17 years. And I really, and this is not bragging, this is from humility. I got my first Broadway chair in 1999 and I've not been unemployed since then. So I'm in my 20th year of straight employment as a guitar player. People say, you get bored on Broadway? I'm going, you know how hard it is to find a steady gig in the music business?
Yeah.
I'm not bored. I am grateful.
Yeah.
So, man, I'm lucky. I'm the luckiest guy I know.
Well, man, I can't thank you enough for your time. You are a lucky guy, and I wish you nothing but, you know, another 50 years of more luck and keep doing what you're doing. It's really nice talking to you. Everybody, please, it's the holidays. It's a great time. This is a wonderful book. It's called Do Stand So Close, My Improbable Adventure as Sting's Guitarist by Jeffrey Lee Campbell. Please go check it out on Amazon. It's a great book, really easy to read. It feels good. It's very conversational. It's incredibly interesting. And it's just got some great stories in there. He just, you know, not even the tip of the iceberg in our conversation today. And I thank you very much for all your time, man, and transparency.
Craig,
I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Craig. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Anytime. And next time, whatever you're doing next, you come back on the show, unless it's like haberdashery or something. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks again to Jeffrey Lee Campbell for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And please go check out his book, Do Stand So Close, My Improbable Adventurous Stings Guitarist. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.